This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Who's Your Caddy? Looping for the Great, Near Great, and Reprobates of Golf by Rick Riley. Read by Grover Gardner. Introduction. Jam Boy. You ever notice anybody standing next to Boston Red Sox pitcher Pedro Martinez as he's firing cheese at the Yankees? Ever notice any reporters kneeling down in the huddle as Brett Favre calls red right, X cross, Y drag wheel in the huddle? Ever notice any slow white guys helping Allen Iverson decide which direction the air conditioning is coming from as he sets up for a three-pointer? Me neither. Only golf lets you do it. Only in golf can a schmo like me lurk right there next to David Duval in the middle of the fairway as he decides what he's going to hit to a green surrounded by 10,000 people. Only in golf can a hack like me read a putt at the Masters as a huge gallery watches in absolute silence. Only in golf can a pest like me help Jack Nicklaus decide whether it's a hard 7 or an easy 8. Personally, I told Jack, I'd scull a 9. Which is the main reason I wanted to write this book. I'll never play golf like those guys. I'll never play it like those guys' gardeners. But as a caddy, I can be closer to great athletes without actually being one than in any other sport. But I didn't want to just be inside the head of great golfers. I wanted to be inside the head of golf itself. Awful golfers, blind golfers, gambling golfers, celebrity golfers, crazed golfers, and guru golfers. Carrying a bag for 18 holes is known in caddies as a loop. And I wanted to find the perfect loop, the funniest loop, and the worst loop. Besides, when you caddy, you get to hang out with caddies. That's the other reason I wanted to write it. I happen to love caddies. It's about time somebody stood up for them. Do you realize in the early 1920s in this country, rich guys would hire two caddies, one to carry the bag and one to cover himself in jelly in order to attract flies away from the golfers? They were known as jam boys. Can you imagine doing that to anyone now? Except, of course, members of Congress. I happen to think caddies deserve better, mostly because caddies are more fun than strippers and firehouse poles. When I cover a golf tournament for Sports Illustrated, I'd be toast without caddy quotes. I'll send a limo for the caddies. All the stuff you hear from the players, agents, swing coaches, mind gurus, flex trainers, and masseurs don't equal one cigarette-smoking caddy going, "Some bitch is golfing his ball," or, "My man is hooking like Divine Jones." By the way, I never took any money out of any caddy's pocket. The deal was the same whenever I approached a pro. I couldn't be paid. The player could do anything with my percentage he wanted, including keeping it, giving it to his caddy, or lighting cigars with it, but I couldn't get a dime. I was stunned at the kind of people who took me up on it. I mean, would you want me near your sticks? I can't imagine what they got out of it, but I know I learned as much about golf from these 2 years as I had in 22 years of covering the game before then. From Tommy Aaron at the Masters, I learned silence. From Casey Martin, guts. From Tom Lehman, family. From John Daly, humor. From Nicklaus, mortality. From David Duval, I learned how easy the game can be, and from Bob Newhart, how hard. From Jill McGill, I learned how tough it is to play with skill but not enough passion, and from Deepak Chopra, passion but not enough skill. I still don't know what I learned from Donald Trump. And from Bob Andrews, who is blind, I learned how much I love the game itself, for itself. Oh, one last thing. You're sitting there going, how come you didn't ask Tiger? I did. I asked Tiger 100 ways. I asked him if I could substitute for his usual man, Stevie Williams, in a tournament, or an exhibition, or a practice round, or a casual round, or even 9 crummy practice rounds at his home course of Isleworth in Orlando. And he'd always say the same thing. No. Why not? I asked. Because, he explained, I suck. I need good help. This is a guy who can make a wad of balata do the rumba on the tip of a flagstick from 208 yards away. How much help does he need? After I'd accepted the fact I was never going to get Tiger, I saw in the paper that Warren Buffett, the legendary investor and one of the richest men on the planet, paid $100,000 to caddy for Tiger as part of a one-day charity. 6 months later, I happened to be at an AIDS benefit in Lincoln, Nebraska, saw Buffett there, marched right up to him and said, "What gives?" He said Tiger didn't really let him caddy. "I pretty much just sat in the cart," he said. But on the 18th, Tiger said, "Mr. Buffett, I want to play you this last hole for some serious money." "Uh-oh," said Buffett, who happens to be worth billions. "How much is serious?" $5, said Tiger. Buffett thought about it and said, "That wouldn't be too fair, do you think? You against me? I'm a 20 handicap." And Tiger said, "Yeah, but I'll be playing on my knees." So they bet. Tiger got down on his knees and hit a rope-hook 260-yard drive down the fairway, made bogey on the hole, and took the $5 off Buffett. But then Buffett cleared his throat and said, "Aren't you forgetting something?" Tiger couldn't think what it might be. "My 10%, he said. "That's 50 cents. And that's how you get to be a billionaire. Chapter 1. The Masters. Get Your Mouth Off My Ball. Having never caddied in my life, I needed a smallish place to start out, away from the spotlight, a podunk kind of tournament. Naturally, I chose the Masters. In front of thousands of people, in the greatest tournament in golf, I made my professional caddying debut, looping for 64-year-old Tommy Ahren, the 1973 champion. I think he'd tell you it went quite well, unless you count tiny little nitpickings, such as my dropping the towel 11 times, the head cover 4, the putter cover 6, standing in the wrong place at the wrong time, standing in the right place at the wrong time, forgetting to give him his putter, his ball, his driver, being too close to him, being too far from him, letting the clubs clink too much as I walked, letting myself clink too much as I walked, the infamous mouth incident, and the awful, shameful thing that happened on number 5 that none involved shall ever forget. This was Friday. We were paired with Sponge, who caddies for New Zealander Michael Campbell, and Fanny Sunnison, who won 6 majors with Nick Faldo and now is the bag woman for Nota Begay, who hates me very much, despite the fact that I've never caddied for him. Sponge and Fanny. Sounds like a British sex club. "I say, Nigel, didn't I see you last night at the Sponge and Fanny?" What happened was, Ahren hit a 3-iron at number 5 into the left greenside bunker, then splashed out. I handed him his putter and then nervously set about my raking duties. The crowd was huge around that green, as they are around most Augusta greens, and nobody was ready to putt yet, so I could feel all the eyes on me. I had dropped my towel once already that day and had 500 people yell, "Caddy, caddy, towel," as though I were President Bush's Secret Service agent and had dropped my gun. "Caddy, caddy, Uzi." So I knew they were watching. I raked as I have raked my own bunkers far too many times, climbed out, then placed the rake on the grass behind. That's when I noticed Ahren staring at my rake job, then glancing at Fanny. Ahren nodded at her. She nodded back. Begay nodded. Sponge nodded back. For all I know, the huge crowd nodded. Only one of us had no idea what all the nodding was about. Suddenly, Fanny dashed over to the rake, picked it up, got back in the bunker, and did it again. Completely. I was to suffer the ultimate caddy humiliation. Re-raked. I was left with nothing to do but stand there and watch, humiliated. It was like a coach calling timeout in the middle of the Super Bowl and showing a quarterback how to put his hands under the center's butt. And that's when I realized the horrible flaw in this book idea. Just because somebody lets you do something doesn't mean you necessarily should go out and do it. The fact that I, an absolute novice know-nothing, could get a bag and traipse my size 12s across the hallowed ground of Augusta National tells you how dangerously easy this whole idea was. At the 2000 Masters, every past champion got a lifetime invitation, even if they were 111 years old. The rule has changed now, but then it meant if Byron Nelson, then 89, felt like playing in next year's Masters, he could play. Naturally, since 1966, he has had the good sense not to. Luckily, guys like 1957 champion Doug Ford, then 78, did not have good sense. He played every year until they made him stop in 2002. In the 2000 Masters, he went out there, threw a little 94 at them, and then withdrew. Meanwhile, a very good player sat home and bit his putter. Naturally, figuring Ford was not exactly counting on winning and therefore might suffer an insufferable caddy and get in a book, I called him first. "Mr. Ford," I began, "I'm doing a book on caddying and..."
"Already got a caddy," Ford snapped. "Had him for 25 years.
"Sure," I said, "but I was thinking just this once you might allow..."
Click.
May his bunions burst. Finally, the agent for Aaron called back and said Aaron would let me caddy Wednesday only as a tryout for the next year. Said we'd play 9 holes and then the par 3 contest, and that would give him an idea of exactly how horrible I was. Yes. I started researching Aaron, who, it turns out, is famous for 3 things. 1, saving the Masters from having to put up with J.C. Sneed every year by beating him by 1 shot in 1973. 2, writing down an incorrect par 4 instead of a birdie 3 on the 17th hole for Sunday playing partner Roberto De Vicenzo in 1968. De Vicenzo signed the card anyway, causing him to keep that 1 stroke higher score, causing him to miss his rightful spot in what would have been a 2-man playoff with Bob Golby, who was then declared the winner. When told of it, De Vicenzo did not blame Aaron. Instead, he said, "What a stupid I am." 3, not being Hank Aaron's brother, though people ask him all the time anyway, despite the fact that the baseball Aarons are black and this golfing Aaron is white. "No," Tommy tells them, "I'm taller." He'd played in 37 Masters, won the par 3 tournament 1 year with a 5-under-22, and had missed more cuts than a drunk surgeon. However, in 2000, Aaron became the oldest player ever to make the cut, 63 years, 1 month, when he shot 72, 74, 146, 3-under the cut, the first 2 days. Of course, he wound up dead last by 5 shots at 25 over, but still, on that Friday night, he was 3 shots better than Ollie, 7 than Daly, and 9 than Ben Crenshaw. "My man." I reached him on his cell phone. "Meet me at the bag room at 7:30 sharp tomorrow morning," he said. "We'll play a practice round, and then we'll play the par 3. Having slept not at all, I was at the holy place by 7 a.m., and by this I mean the Augusta Caddy Shack. It was a white brick building with lockers, tables, a TV playing ESPN, and a little caddyshack grill where a huge black man cooks delicacies for the caddies, such as hamburger, $2, cheeseburger, also $2, soup, 50 cents, and fries, 50 cents. Of course, business was a little slow this week on account of, for Masters Week only, a giant cake display case being brought in and filled with pimento cheese sandwiches, fruit, Gatorade, pop, and candy. Now, who is going to pay a whole 50 cents for soup when you can get free pimento cheese sandwiches? I saw Pete Bender, who carried Ian Baker Finch at the 1993 British Open, which tells you how good Bender is, and he said that Augusta is good, but the best caddy room in the free world is the Players' Championship. Oh, man, hot breakfasts, hot lunch, big-screen TV, couches, Bender said wistfully. Here's a guy carrying Rocco Mediate and probably making $100,000 a year, and he's thrilled at the idea of being able to actually eat a meal during his 10-hour workday. The worst, he said, was Arnold Palmer's tournament, Bay Hill. They got nothing, zero, not even a room to change in. Shame, Arnie, shame. I put on the classic all-white painter overalls with the green Masters hat they give you. Free. It's the classiest uniform in golf, with the player's number velcroed on the left breast. I got number 411. The defending champ's caddy always gets 1. The Augusta logo on the right breast pocket and the player's name on the back. Beautiful. Like a fool, I forgot to steal it when I was done. I tried to ignore the sign that read, "Caddies are required to wear white flat-soled sneakers." All I had were black soft-spiked golf shoes. This made me stand out like a bridesmaid in construction boots. Also, I found out later, on hot days, guys wear nothing but boxers underneath. There have been rumors of guys going commando under them, and I can only pray that A, it isn't true, and B, if it is true, I didn't get fluff-soled overalls. They handed me a yardage book, which looked like Sanskrit. It made no sense, just numbers and swirls and acronyms. It must be how the New Yorker looks to an illiterate. I was standing there looking like Rubik's twit brother when Cubby, Davis Love's caddy, said, "Don't even bother, Rook, you'll never understand it." Cubby is one of the great lads. When not caddying, he's always got the sports section in one hand and an unlit cigar in the mouth. His breakup with Brad Faxon was one of the most tragic in tour history. 13 years together. But that's how it is. No alimony, no keeping the china. Just like that, everybody notices you're not lugging the old bag with you everywhere you go. Cubby and Faxon used to be quite a pair. They had a language all their own. For yardages, for instance, Cubby would say, "Okay, you got 123 plus Elway and a little Reagan," which meant you have 123 yards to the front of the green plus another 7 yards, Elway's jersey number, to the flagstick, with the wind throwing your ball a little to the right, Reagan's politics. Or Cubby would say, "You got 214 yards to the front, plus Michael, Jordan, which is 23 yards, and a little Clinton, wind going left." "What, you don't speak fluent, Cubby?" Cubby has a jersey number for every conceivable yardage, but I always thought that there were more they didn't use. For instance, what about, "You got 134 plus Hal," 4 for the number of Hal Sutton's wives, or "You got 189 plus O.J., Simpson's two murders," or "It's 201 plus Anna, Kournikova, a perfect 10. The yardages in the book were from every conceivable place you could think of, sprinkler heads, bushes, benches. You half expected to see distances marked to Martha Burke's offices written in. But there were also strange numbers way to the sides of the hole drawings accompanied by strange letters, like ICYFU 219 and ICYRFU 174. Cubby explained it to me. ICYFU means in case you fuck up, and ICYRFU means in case you really fuck up. Then somebody came up to him and said, "Cubby, did you get those bad numbers on 11? "What bad numbers?" Cubby said. And the guy said, "Where it says 64 and 56, it's really 60 and 51. I made a secretive note of it in my book, which Cubby slyly noticed. Then Cubby said to the guy, "And did you get the one on 16? It's 144 from the front tee there, not 164. And his buddy goes, "Yeah, I got it, but did you get the one on 18? That first bush isn't there anymore, so that 128 is really 182. And I'm flipping frantically through the pages, trying to find the stupid 16th hole, when I hear them both suddenly break up into hysterics. Great fun to con the Rook. As God is my witness, I will get them someday. I jammed the yardage book in my overall pockets, plus some sandwiches and apples, plus I had my wallet in there, my notepad, 4 pens, and a cell phone, which I forgot to leave in the car and is strictly forbidden at Augusta. I walked out there looking like a man shoplifting porcupines. I checked my watch. It was 7:29. I started sprinting for the bag room. Then I was reminded of one of Augusta's big rules. No running. I sprint-walked. People suddenly started parting seas for me. People jabbed each other. I was wondering what was going on when I heard, "There's Aaron's caddy." The overalls were, it turns out, a big deal. I was Augusta royalty. I was wearing the white, the green, the logo. I was the real deal. You know, if a guy were single. I made it by 7:30. Luckily, Aaron wasn't there yet. And he wasn't there by 7:45 either. Or 8. Or 8:30, 9, or 9:30. "Welcome to the pro gap," Joe LaCava, caddy for Fred Couples, told me. "What's the pro gap?" I asked. "The difference between when the pro says he'll meet you and when he actually shows up." Of course, caddies accept the pro gap as part of caddy life, but as they pointed out, let you be late, and you're as fired as Anna Nicole Smith's dietitian. Still, it was sort of caddy Star Wars outside that bag room. Fluff was there for Jim Furyk. LaCava was there. Jim McKay, the world-renowned Bones, my personal caddy hero who had hauled Phil Mickelson for 10 years by then. And, of course, the Joe Namath of caddies, Bruce Edwards, Tom Watson's longtime Sancho Panza. Edwards happened to be the person Tom Watson told, "I'm going to chip this in," on the 17th hole at Pebble Beach at the 1982 U.S. Open, which he did to beat J.W. Nicklaus himself. Finally, at 11:30, 4 hours late, Aaron showed up. He was much taller than I thought he'd be, maybe 6'1", still slender, elegantly dressed, curly gray hair, glasses, and a visor. "I'm just going to go into the champions' room, the locker room at Augusta reserved for past champions, and then we'll go. Meet me on the range in, what, 45 minutes? "Sure," I said cheerfully. "Sure, what's another 45 minutes? No problem. Perhaps I'll knit another sweater." The bag was simple and blue, with no sponsor on it, and heavier than meatloaf. What's this guy got in there, anvils? I remembered the time British golf writer Bill Elliott spent a day caddying for Faldo for a story. Elliott struggled under its weight all day until he discovered afterward that Faldo had snuck a brick and 36 extra balls into the bottom of the bag for a laugh. There is nobody that will crack you up like that madcap Nick Faldo. I made my way past the ropes, into forbidden territory, the range, the place where no writer is allowed to go at the Masters, nor fan nor photographer. Self-conscious and thrilled, I tried to think of what to do so as not to appear self-conscious and thrilled. So, naturally, I decided to eat. I sat on the bench and pulled a pimento cheese sandwich out, and an apple and a Gatorade. I was about to take my first bite when I noticed, for the first time, approximately 1,000 people watching me. The bleachers behind the range were full of fans, and at that moment nobody was actually hitting balls, so they were watching me. I tried not to spill. Just then, Bruce Edwards sat down next to me. Sitting on that bench, him waiting for the great Watson and me waiting for Aaron, I naturally ruined the moment by hounding him desperately for advice. "Just remember the three ups," he said. "Three ups?" I asked. "Show up, keep up, and shut up." I asked Edwards if he ever wished he'd have done something else for a living. "Never," he said. In fact, in 1976, Tom wanted me to quit caddying for him and go to school. He even offered to pay for it. He wasn't winning much then, and he said, "Look, go get your degree and have a real life." So I thought about it, and I came back to him, and I said, "No, I like this life." And I'm sure as hell glad I did, because that next year he won 4 times, and the next year 5. And went on to a career that has so far paid like a winning lotto ticket, and kept Edwards in cold beer and nice boats ever since. Finally, Watson himself showed up, about an hour late. "I'm sorry," Edwards chided. "Did you mean 12 o'clock Kansas City time?" "Caddies won, pro gap nothing." They walked off, and Edwards grinned at me. I thought maybe I should say that to my man. "I'm sorry, did you mean 7:30 a.m. sharp Thursday?" But then I thought, perhaps this is a wisecrack one might try after caddying 30 years, not 30 seconds. Aaron came striding onto the range, and I came striding after him, holding a bag of balls which I, ever the sharp caddy, had secured and made ready. Except when we got to our stall on the range and I plopped them down, they turned out to be the wrong balls. "I play Callaway," he said, staring at me. I jog-walked, no running, back to the ball boys and said, "I need Callaway, fast." And they said, "Red or blue?" And I said, "Bloody hell, you have red or blue?" I took a bag of each. Aaron was accompanied by his coach, 79-year-old Manuel de la Torre, the head pro at Milwaukee Country Club, one of the foremost teachers of the Swing the Club school of golf. And already he was tutoring Aaron on how to swing the club. "What happened there?" Manuel said. "I felt like I swung it a little right of the target." "And where did it go?" said Manuel. "Right of the target." "Correct," said Manuel. Whoa, this is the magic that they're discussing? This is the inside conversations that we're all dying to get up close and hear? We went through 2 bags of blue Callaways, went through another bag in the bunker, where I learned upon receiving a dirty look that you want to flip the practice ball to him so that he doesn't have to move his feet. Putted for a while, and then, suddenly, miraculously, we were on the first tee at Augusta National during the 65th playing of the Masters tournament. It was wonderful, until Aaron uttered 5 awful words. "Do you know Scott Hoke?" "He's got nobody going with him either, so we're going with him." Suddenly, I was turning around to shake the hand of a man I'd mocked to 21 million readers more than once in print for A, skipping the British Open every year because it's too expensive, B, missing a 2-foot putt that would have won him the 1989 Masters, and C, being voted least liked player on tour in a poll of his peers. Hoke looked at me. I looked at him. He knew. "Scott, Rick Reilly," I said, holding my hand out. He looked at me, looked at the hand, said, "I know who you are," and began to tee up his ball. Oops. Aaron gave me a look. I stared at my shoes. Not a shot hit yet, and I was already causing him problems. Still, I was thinking that Scott Hoke has had to play with people he dislikes and who dislike him quite often in his career, like, say, on the order of every Thursday through Sunday. So, off we went. Of all the signs in the world, the most ignored has to be the little white and green sign on the first tee at the Masters that reads, "Play only one ball, please." In fact, about the only place only one ball is played during practice rounds is at that first tee. Otherwise, players play about 8 balls. Players hit all kinds of second shots, third shots, dozens of chips, putts, bunker shots, pitches, and lags from every possible angle on every green. This makes practice days very difficult for your average everyday caddy and absolute pure Dante's Inferno for your basic rook. It was, "Throw those back to me and rake those spots and let me hit those again, Rick." If I'd had a methamphetamine habit, I couldn't have done it all. Clubs to be cleaned, clubs to be exchanged for different clubs, balls to be cleaned, balls to be retrieved, bunkers to be raked. And that was just the stuff I knew I should be doing. God knows what I wasn't doing. I almost quit. If it hadn't been the first hole, I might have. At one point on number one, I got so confused I put our 8-iron in Hoke's bag, they were both white, until Hoke's caddy cleared his throat. Caddy etiquette. If it were one day later and Hoke played the hole with the club in there, it would have been a 2-shot penalty. On Hoke. And then he really wouldn't like me. Exhausted and dehydrated by the time we reached the number 2 tee box, I stood the bag up and went for a cup of water. When I came back, Tommy was pissed. "You never take your hand off the bag when it's standing up," he growled. "It can and will tip over at the worst possible time and place, like on my golf ball." Good point. That would be another 2-stroke penalty, wouldn't it? Played one hole, nearly caused 4 shots in penalties. Nice start. Tommy Aaron is just slightly more finicky than the Sultan of Brunei. For instance, he informed me on the second hole not to hand him his putter until he reached the green. I always thought there's nothing better than a long walk with your putter, meaning you've hit the green, life is good. But no. One time, on number 5, he hit a chip that looked like it was going to be short. "Get up," I said to it. He turned to me. "Keep your mouth off my ball." I was confused. "I didn't use my mouth," I said earnestly. "I'm using this wet towel here." I held it up for him as proof that I wasn't popping his ball in my mouth to wash it. "No, no. Keep your mouth off my ball. Don't talk to it. I want it to get up as much as you do. It doesn't help me to know that you're over there telling it to get up or get down or whatever. It just adds to the pressure." I said, "Okay," and I thought about it. It adds to the pressure? You'd think he'd want to know that somebody is cheering him on, rooting for him and his stupid ball. How is that more pressure? It seems to me it's dividing the pressure in half. You and me, pal, a team. But the more I thought about it, the more I understood what he was trying to say. What he was saying is, if I hear you urging my shots to do a certain thing, sit, bite, run, cut, and they don't, I'm going to feel like I've let you down, too. I've got a family to support, and friends here, and fans, and press. The last thing I need is a caddy piling on, okay? It's like me. I write a weekly sports column. The last thing I want is my wife to call at the office and say, "Hey, how are you doing this week? Is the lead going to be good? The kids and I are really hoping it's going to be funny." Still, there were other things. He'd hit a drive and people would applaud and we'd walk down the fairway and he'd say to me, "I can't understand that." "I'm sorry," I said, fingering my wet towel in case I needed it as evidence again. The gallery applauding. Can't they see I hit that one in the heel? I mean, don't they know anything about golf? I wanted to say, "Well, you're 64 years old. You've already told me you're playing with a painful hammer toe, an arthritic hip, a bone spur in your neck, a little vertigo, and insomnia. I suppose they're just glad you got it airborne." One time, somebody in the crowd hollered, "Hey, Tommy!" and Tommy gave them the tiniest of waves. "That's funny, isn't it?" he said. "I'm sorry," I said for the 116th time. If I were at a tournament, I don't think I'd speak unless I was spoken to. I'm trying to work here, you know. How would they like it if I hung around the insurance office all day while they were working and said, "Hey, Fred, way to go!" I agreed, of course. They should all be hung from the old tree on the clubhouse veranda. On the third hole, Aaron said, "Seemed like there was some tension between you and Scott on the first tee." Uh-oh. Here it comes. I've got no chance now. I'll get the rest of this day and see you later. "Yeah, well, I noticed that too," I said. "Not sure what that was about." He stared at me for a second and then walked on. Uh-oh. At the end of 9, Aaron had played well. I had us at 1 over par 37. But he suddenly decided to quit for the day. He also said he wasn't going to play the par 3 tournament. "And I'm afraid I'm going to stay with the caddy I was given," he said. "You can take the clubs to the bag room. Thanks for your help." Crushed. Heartbroken. Untipped. Sacked after 9 practice holes at the Masters. If not Aaron, who would ever let me out? My book advance flashed before my eyes. I was doomed. Desperate, I said, "You sure? Because I'll be here all week. Maybe if your caddy comes up hurt or something?" He just smiled and said, "I doubt it." I hung around in my beloved caddy overalls as long as I could. A few Japanese people took my picture. I finally had to take them off. I didn't see how a caddy could ask Tiger Woods a question in the press conference. Tiger, how do you feel about people's mouths on your balls?" The next day, Thursday, I followed Aaron and his caddy, a local, a few holes. I felt like a jilted lover. But then I noticed something wonderful. I couldn't hear, but Aaron was jawing at him animatedly. I thought maybe it was the dreaded mouth-on-ball syndrome, but it seemed worse. Aaron was walking away, shaking his head, and the caddy was shrugging his shoulders. Could he have accidentally said, "Good shot"? Aaron shot 81. I found him in the clubhouse after lunch and said it looked like he'd played fairly well, but something seemed to be bothering him. "That caddy," he said, shaking his head, "has the worst damn attitude of any caddy I've ever had. Just a piss-poor attitude. He was pouting the whole time. He gave me a read that was just flat wrong on 16, and I told him so, and he pouted. He had his head down all the time. The most miserable, worst, goddamn horrible attitude I've ever seen." Hope springs anew. I cleared my throat. "Well, if he's that bad, how about this? I'll pay him to stay off your bag the rest of the week, and I'll work for you for free." Aaron thought about it, and thought about it some more, and finally said, "Okay." "Pinocchio, you're a real boy." On the way to the press room, higher than Tokyo rent, I saw Carl Jackson, Ben Crenshaw's Masters-only caddy, the one who gave Crenshaw the little ball-positioning tip before the 1995 Masters that Crenshaw credited for helping him win. I imagined me doing that for Aaron. Aaron to press. "I know it's incredible, a 64-year-old man winning, but it never would have happened without my caddy, Rick. He noticed my left pinky knuckle was pronating slightly, and it made all the difference in the world. Rick, I want you to have the jacket." Me. "No, I couldn't." Aaron. "Oh, nonsense. Try it on." Me. "Well..." I paid the old caddy $150 for the day he missed on Wednesday and another $150 for the day he was going to miss Friday, and I said I'd pay him $150 for any day after that, although after the 81, Masters Chairman Hootie Johnson was going to vogue across the 18th green naked before that happened. Still, the guy made $300 for sitting on his couch watching on television while I humped the bag up Augusta's Hills for bupkis. Okay, I undermined him, but I ain't holding any telethons for him. Friday morning came, and as Aaron met me, he warned, "Now don't get too excited out there." "I'm sorry," I said. "If the caddy gets all nervous and excited, it seeps into me, so just be quiet and calm." "Got it." When we got to the first tee, Aaron said, "Rick, do you know Nota Begay?" Uh-oh. I did know Begay, and he knew me, and I could tell that from the glare I was getting. Begay had spent a week in an Albuquerque prison after his second DUI, only it wasn't exactly the gulag. He was part of a work-release program, so he was allowed to get up in the morning, go hit balls at his club, have lunch at the club, then play 18 holes in the afternoon, then dinner at the club, then back to the prison to sleep. I said they ought to call the jail Swing Swing. I said that for most guys, that wasn't prison, that was a week at the Myrtle Beach Red Roof Inn. I'd heard Begay was ticked off about it. Still, unlike Hoke, he begrudgingly shook my hand. I made a note to stay very clear of his tee shots. Aaron might have said something to me like, "I noticed some tension between you and Noda there," except for the fact that he found something that annoyed him about Begay and Campbell right off. He canned a 40-footer on number one to save par, walked over to me and whispered, "Did you see that?" "I'm sorry," I said nervously, fingering my wet towel and trying to figure out what I'd done now. "Neither of those guys said nice putt. That's the way it is with these younger players. They don't see any shot but their own." "Selfish," I said, shaking my head. For once he was mad at somebody other than me. It didn't last long. On number two, Aaron had a little chip back from above the green. I gave him the wedge and stood there a second, and then realized I'd better get the bag to the side of the hole that would lead to the next tee box, as all good caddies do. He was still eyeing the chip from behind the shot, and he gave me a dirty little look. I froze. Then he chipped. Going down the third fairway, he said, "The clubs are making too much noise." "I'm sorry?" "They're making too much noise. Listen to the noise they're making. Quiet them down." He walked ahead of me in a kind of huff. I wandered over to Fanny. "I can't believe this guy," I complained to her, struggling up the hill at number three. "He says my clubs make too much noise when I walk. I mean, Christ, what am I supposed to do, buy 14 mufflers and..." "Yes," she said, "yours do make too much noise." I stared at her. She stared at me. "Take your towel and wrap it through the middle of the irons, like this. Then walk with your hand over them." I tried it. They quieted right down. Fanny Sunnison is a goddess. On number four, the par three, he was standing in the middle of the tee box, about 8 feet from where I was standing with the bag, just to the left of the tee markers. "Rick, come over here," he said. I had a flutter of excitement. He was finally trusting me enough to ask me advice. Maybe he wanted to talk wind, maybe yardage, maybe club selection. So I stood the bag up where it was and walked over to him. He looked at me like he'd just swallowed a cockroach. "With the bag," he said, irritated. I didn't understand why he wanted me to drag the bag the 8 feet out to the middle of the tee markers when it was much easier for him to simply take the club himself. Fanny and Sponge weren't doing that. Their guys would stand by their bag, pick the stick, and walk the 8 feet. But so be it. I got the bag and brought it to him. He took his club. I went back to where I was, and he hit it. But on the sixth hole, another par three, I forgot and the same thing happened. "Rick, bring the bag," he said sharply, and I schlepped it out there again. He took a 6-iron and made the most gorgeous swing, nearly making a hole in one, missing by inches left. As the huge crowd roared, he came over to me and looked me right in the eye. I figured he was going to say something clever or snappy, something like, "Pulled it," or "Take a suck of that." But instead he yelled, "Now, goddammit, I'm not going to tell you again. I don't want to have to walk clear over there to get a goddamn club." There was a hush around the crowd at the tee box. Caddy whipping. All I could do was clean my little 6-iron and stare at the bottom of the bag. I would ask Couples' caddy, Joe LaCava, about this later. I said, "Why would a guy want me to pick up the bag and take it to the middle of the tee box when he could just take it with him when he steps out there?" And Joe LaCava said simply, "Because he is a professional golfer." I didn't know what that answer meant then, but I'd learn. On number eight, I watched Sponge and Fanny give their guys 3 woods so they wouldn't have to walk clear back to the tee, so I did the same. I was kneeling there, trying to catch my wind, when I felt a tap on my shoulder. It was Begay. "Here is where he lets me have it," I thought. "Here is where he spikes my kidneys, or gets me with a homemade prison shiv." Instead, he said, "You should go wait with the others." I looked around, and Sponge and Fanny were 150 yards up the 8th fairway, resting happily in the shade. Left the rook behind. After that, it all fell apart for us. Aaron bogeyed the par 5 8th, despite being right in front in 2, and then doubled 10, where he chunked a chip into a bunker, then 3-putted. Then we headed into Amen Corner, and it was a thrill to be inside the ropes at the most famous section of holes in golf. Nobody gets inside the ropes at Augusta except players and caddies and the scorer. Not coaches, not photographers, not press, not rules officials, nobody. It's virginal land, pristine. If Ansel Adams were around, he'd shoot it. Walking down 11 fairway, I was struck by the hugeness of the place, the vast space. I'd covered 13 masters, and yet I'd never noticed how deep the woods went to the left of 11 and 12. It looked like Blair Witch 3 in there. Another odd thing. Since the crowds are so huge at Amen Corner, I was aware that every time I moved a step, I was blocking the views of maybe 100 people or more. It was an odd feeling. Move 1 yard this way, and those 100 can't see. 1 yard that way, and those 100 can't see. Great, great fun. I was the god of views, free to give and take away as I saw fit. Oh, you drove the Dodge Dart clear from Manitoba for your first masters? Sorry, I choose to stand here. All my life I'd wanted to stand on the 12 green during the Masters. I'd always wondered, what's it like out there, viewed by thousands of fans, but all from 160 yards away? Every movement watched through binoculars, but not a sound heard. For fans, it's like watching a silent movie. But on the green, so far away from the thousands watching, you find out. Fuck me, Begay said when his par putt missed. Aaron missed a four-footer for par, but to his credit did not say, fuck me. The thousands back in the gallery probably assume they're saying, well played there, Tommy, and oh, a spot of bad luck there, chum. And instead they're going, fuck me. There is nothing in golf like the 13th tee box either. Set back into the azaleas and dogwoods, it must be the most beautiful inland tee in the world. And yet to the players, it is more famously known as the home of the pea bush. Players and caddies go back behind a huge bush and pee. There are not many porta-potties at Augusta, and the ones they have are packed, so 13 has become the traditional whizzing ground. Not wanting to piss on history, I also loosed the lizard back there, and as I was doing so, it hit me that some of the great names in golf history—Jones, Snead, Hogan, Nicholas—had all squirted on this very bush. It made me proud. It also made me want to throw out my shoes first chance I got. We made an awful double bogey at 13, but it wasn't our fault. We wound up in a divot after our second shot, had to blade it out of there and over, putted way, way by in 4, half-lagged it up in 5, and missed a 3-footer for 6. I still feel if I could have spoken to his ball, it would have helped. Now we were 10 over par with 5 holes to go. We were headed for 90. Doug Ford, here we come. But at 14, 15, and 16, we made great pars, nearly made 3 birdies, and it was a privilege to carry the bag of a man who can play that well at 64 years old with more ailments than the Mayo Clinic. The pars made him so chipper, in fact, that I offered a small bit of chit-chat. This place has great memories for you, huh? He said it did. He said he hated to come and play so badly as he did this week. Shooting in the 80s is not my idea of fun, he said. He said he loved Augusta and loved the memories of his win here, when he made birdie at 18 and had no idea he'd won until later, since he wasn't in the last group. I offered up a potential grenade, seeing as how we were coming to the 18th tee box. How did the whole De Vincenzo snafu happen, I said, walking just out of swinging putter range. He was quite happy to talk about it. It was really so ridiculous, he said. In those days, you'd check your scorecard at a little card table they set up, right out in the open, under the sun. Roberto was a little mad that he'd made bogey on the last hole, and so he just signed the card without even looking at it. He threw it on the table and left. Whoosh. Now, I'm very meticulous about my scores. I double and triple check them. My card checked out, and I was about to leave when I looked up at the scoreboard and saw that it said, De Vincenzo, 11 under. And it hit me that something was wrong. I had him at one higher than that, 10 under. I checked it against the scoreboard and realized what had happened. I said to one of the officials, better get Roberto back here, this isn't right. I felt bad, but people make mistakes on your scorecard. Happens all the time, you have to check it. At 18, Aaron made an unbelievable chip shot, a purposely bladed chip from against the collar that he aimed 180 degrees away from the hole, ran over the green, down the hump, over the fringe on the other side, and back to within 6 inches of the hole. It was the kind of shot only a man who'd played 37 masters could have made, and even Begay and Campbell put their putters down to applaud. Tommy checked his card, meticulously, then gave me a tour of the champion's locker room, which is the tiniest locker room you've ever been in, yet with the greatest collection of nameplates ever in one room. His was under Jimmy Demeritz. Then he had a lunch and a couple of vodkas, and I had a beer, and suddenly he was the nicest man you'd ever want to meet, chatty, funny, cordial. He gave me his critique of my maiden loop. For a first-time caddy, you weren't that bad, he said. It seemed like you wanted to get rid of the bag at all costs. Most caddies walk right up on the green with the bag on their shoulder, wash the ball, make sure everything's right, and then get rid of the bag. You just wanted to get rid of the bag right away, no matter what. Get rid of the bag, then come and check on me. That was true, of course, for two reasons. One, I was taught you don't walk on the green with your bag on your shoulder as it makes deep footprints in the green. Guess not. And two, that stupid bag was heavier than a lead piano. I asked him if there were any scorecard problems this time, 33 years later. As a matter of fact, he said, Michael Campbell had 2 incorrect scores for me, on 2 and on 8. I had 6s on both, and he had me for 5s. I'm telling you, it happens all the time. What a stupid Campbell is. We could have used those 5s, by the way. We finished 4th worst in the tournament at 163, just 27 shots behind Tiger's 2-day 136, which would lead to his 4-day 16-under 272, which would merely win him the consecutive Grand Slam, is all. Only Billy Casper had a higher 2-day score at 167. Gabe Brewer had an 84 the first day and withdrew. We were 90th out of 96 in driving distance at 241 yards, 66 yards behind Tiger, and 90th in greens in regulation, 13 total, but we were 30th in putts. Then again, we did a whole hell of a lot better than the charming Doug Ford, who made a 6 on the first hole, withdrew immediately, took his $5,000 participant's honorarium, and went home. Class guy. I'll bet he voted against Lincoln, too. Actually, $5,000 to play one hole is about what third-place finisher Phil Mickelson, $380,000, made per hole after playing 72. Maybe he's not so dumb after all. A caddy dictionary. If the caddy says, "So we go Yogi Bear on the last 6 holes and he goes Helicopter City with every one of his bats right there, straight into the Jacques Cousteau. Then he gives me the bullet, bang, just like that. Looks like I'm trolling at Westchester." He means, "So we played each of the last 6 holes in 1-over-par bogey. This made my player very angry and he began throwing each of his clubs in a whirling manner into the nearby body of water. This is the point at which he fired me. It appears I'll be in the parking lot asking players if they need a caddy at the next tournament on the schedule, which is Westchester." Chapter 2. John Daly, Unzipped. Some people parachute off skyscrapers. Some scuba under the polar ice cap. Me, I spend 24 hours as John Daly's caddy. 7 p.m. Sunday. Daly is supposed to be here at the 4,012th celebrity pro-am kickoff dinner of his life. This one is at the Willowbend Country Club in Mashpee on Cape Cod in June 2001. I want a caddy for Daly because absolutely nothing about him says golf. Look at that swing. Like his life, it's way past parallel. Look at that hair. The classic mullet, business in front, party in the back. Look at that body. Like some balls after he smashes them, it's way out of round. Can you imagine what he'd look like if he gave up smoking? But it's also more than that. Daly is so human, it hurts. There is nothing that hasn't happened to him, no weakness he doesn't have, no demon he doesn't duel every day. No athlete today comes with higher highs and lower lows than John Daly. If Psychology Today ever runs a centerfold, he'd be it. And yet, against all odds, he's still out there making it. 7:21 p.m. There is a buzz across the great country club hall. Everybody's favorite train wreck, the 35-year-old Daly, has been spotted. In a room where Boston sports heroes Bobby Orr, John Havlicek, and Dwight Evans are hanging, Daly is the one people want to see in the flesh. Every rich guy in the room wants for his partner tomorrow a confused Arkansas redneck who hasn't won a tournament in 6 years. As he tries to make his way across the room, you notice he doesn't look like anybody else here, a little like Mayberry's Otis in a coat and tie, a bit awkward around country club folk, itching to get away from the stares. And boy do they stare. Nobody else in the history of golf has had their life flayed open on the rocks and devoured the way Daly has. The ongoing wrestling match with alcohol, the 3 demolition derby marriages, the undefeated and untied record against hotel furniture. the gambling losses approaching the GNP of Chile, the 18 he took at Bay Hill, the troika of U.S. Open disasters, walking off after 9 at Congressional, swatting a moving ball at Pinehurst, the 14 he took on the 18th hole at Pebble Beach, the unforgettable image of him shivering and crying on an 85-degree August day at a tournament. He should be doubled over in a little ball in some Idaho cabin by now, refusing to shave or speak. And yet, he stays in front of the cameras. He stays because he has this amazing talent that even he can't kill. He's the longest player in golf. He's got the softest hands. He did not check into the Hotel Orville Moody after he won the 1991 PGA out of absolutely nowhere USA. Instead, 4 years later, Daly won another major, and he won a BC Open in between, and a Bell South, and 2 European Tour events. And those wins kept him out in front of a public and a press that keeps waiting under his window, wondering when he'll jump. And it's not just golf. I've thrown footballs with him. He can throw a 50-yard spiral that will hurt your hand for 2 days. When he was 8 and 9, he made it to the semifinals of the National Punt, Pass, and Kick Contest 2 years in a row. Represented the New Orleans Saints. Wonder if Archie Manning remembers he met the kid. Twice. He kicked a winning 46-yard field goal in high school. He once made 36 straight free throws. He was a Babe Ruth All-Star baseball player. He's a hell of a water skier. Hell, he's even a good dancer. 8:33 p.m. Having dinner next to John Daly is to watch a lot of food go cold. Everybody wants to talk to him, pat him on the back, say good luck. Daly is America's project hope. The world approaches. There's nobody that doesn't like Daly. They know he's not particularly dangerous. Mostly, the only person he ever hurts is himself. And so, everybody's got the cure. Look, a few of us get together every morning and talk about our alcoholism. Why don't you stop by tomorrow? Hey, I know you struggle with your weight. I've got this diet I've developed. John, I know you've lost a few sponsors. I work with this management firm and... They mean well. They do. They see a man with a gift, trying desperately to pitch it all in the dumpster, and they reach out. They all want to be his mother, his father, his big brother, his AA mentor. But help is what Daly runs from the fastest. He's so sick of help that he blew off millions in sponsor money just so he wouldn't have to go to any more rehabs and AA meetings. Just so he could be left alone with his demons. Daly listens intently, takes their cards, says he'll think about it. Later, he'll ashcan the cards on the way to the bar. 9:31 p.m. Gary McCord is emceeing the live auction. He's trying to pump up a one-day spa treatment in New York City. J.D., he yells from the stage, what about it? You could drive the Winnebago right through the front window and never have to leave the front seat. Daly flips him off. And we have a $1,000 bid from John Daly. 9:57 p.m. Daly gets in some FaceTime with Paul Fireman, owner of Willow Bend and CEO of Reebok, the Boston-based shoe godzilla. The whole event is Fireman's baby. That's the reason Daly is here, to pay his respects to Fireman, try to show him he's not a lawn and bottle club waiting to happen. Reebok used to pay Daly millions, then stopped when Daly kept losing TKOs to hotel rooms, engaging in fistfights with tour players' parents, and checking out of alcohol rehab farms before he'd warmed a pillow. I'm hoping maybe if he sees I'm fine, Daly says, he'll take me back. 10:29 p.m. Uh-oh. Tour player Rocco Mediate has persuaded everybody to go to a bar, this little dive 15 minutes from the club. A lot of co-eds, a lot of golf groupies, a bad little band, $2 long necks, more potential trouble than Ray Lewis's limo. In other words, John Daly's kind of place. Here, in one room, is nearly all of his favorite addictions. Alcohol, cigarettes, cheeseburgers, and women. If the joint had an M&M's machine and a pharmacy, we'd have the Big Six covered. Bringing Daly here is like bringing a dieting fat woman to the Sara Lee factory. No problem, Daly says as we enter. I do it all the time. Tonight's trapeze act will be performed without a net. 11:09 p.m. I suggested Daly that today is the first day of the rest of his booty life, considering he has just broken up this very day with his fiancée, Shania Chandler. No way, he says. I ain't looking. Of course, he's a man, so it will take time to recover and open up emotionally again. Maybe in an hour or so. It's odd that he and Shania are history, since the Golf Digest currently on the newsstands has an 18-page spread detailing how blissfully happy they are together. "Fucking bitch," Daly grumbles. "I had a buddy of mine from the FBI tailing her for 3 weeks. Bitch was cheating on me. She was lying to me, and I got proof." I muttered sympathetically. "I've just been trampled by women my whole life," says the man who once wrote a song entitled "All My Exes Wear Rolexes." "Everybody tells me you treat them too damn good, John. I mean, I bought this one a brand new car, a $50,000 ring. Man, I paid her way through college." "And what did you get out of it?" I asked, just trying to be the good caddy. "Well, yeah, she did take care of me through the lowest point of my career." He thinks for a while. "Damn, I just don't get him. Maybe I try to buy love, I don't know. I just thank God I didn't marry the bitch." Daly and any one woman generally have a freshness date of about 18 months. He's always hopelessly in love one time you see him and lovelessly in hate the next time. When he was 21, he married a girl named Dale Crafton of Blytheville, Arkansas. They divorced 2 years later. He then married Betty Fulford, only to find out she was 8 years older than she told him and was still married when he proposed. Although that's not exactly what broke up the marriage. What broke up the marriage may have been Daly coming home to their Castle Pines, Colorado house on a December night in 1992 and busting it apart like a tinker toy town, and nearly Betty with it. They had a daughter, Shina. Then he married the Lur in a walking, curvy three-girl Chrysler billboard at the Bob Hope Chrysler Classic in Palm Springs. Her name was Paulette Dean. They had a daughter, too, Sierra. I told him it seemed like he was always happy with Paulette. "Yeah, until after Sierra was born and she stopped having sex with me," he complained. "Man, that hurt. What did I do that was so wrong she doesn't want to be with me? I mean, I think I'm a damn good lover. I'm a very slow lover. I love oral sex. Not just on me, both ways. I'm very giving. I'll make a woman come 5 or 6 times before I have intercourse with her. Why did I deserve that?" "I did what all guys do when another guy bares his soul. I took a long glug from my beer bottle in order not to say anything." "Someday my kids are going to read about what these women did to their dad," Daly says, "and they're not going to be too happy. They're going to finally see how bad their moms treated me, how money-hungry they all were." Just a guess, but here he may be referring to the estimated $35,000 a month alimony and child support he pays. "I'll find the right one someday. Maybe I just need an 80-year-old woman who'll just take care of me. But I mean, damn, where's a woman who will fight for you?" If Daly would look up, he'd have about 6 ready to do just that right now. Midnight. Still, no alcohol has gone into Daly. Mediate is blotto. I'm a good sheet and a quarter to the wind, but Daly is sober as an Amish librarian. It's weird because Daly used to be such a drunk. He was a Jack Daniels guy, thus the J.D. nickname that still sticks with him. And the more J.D. and J.D. became one fluid, the more he'd hate himself. He used to drive full speed through red lights as a kind of self-punishment. Problem was, Betty and their little girl would be in the car. He'd bust shot glasses in his hand, just out of anger. If you look at his hands, you can see the scars from all the times he punched mirrors. Hotel mirrors, bedroom mirrors, car mirrors. Mirrors showed him all the things he didn't want to see. In fact, later, during the 2002 British Open, Daly's hand was killing him. He went to a doctor who found a piece of glass that had been embedded in a bone for years. They stitched him up, but the stitches came out and Daly used his own method of keeping them together. Superglue. "You and I both know I can't drink whiskey," he says. "I was a mean drunk on whiskey. The last time I drank whiskey was when I was 25 years old. I drank it from the time I was 14 until I was 25. Even today, the smell of whiskey makes me sick. I'll never drink whiskey again, never." Of course, as the song lyric goes, never again is what you swore the time before. 12:18 a.m. The guitarist comes over during a break and asks Daly if he'd mind playing a song with them. They ask Daly this in nearly every bar he goes into anywhere in the world, and he almost always obliges them one song. And that song is usually Dylan's "Knockin' on Heaven's Door." Daly can play other songs. He's actually pretty good on the guitar. Unfortunately, Daly plays the Dylan song no matter the situation. Once at a make-a-wish dinner for terminally ill children at the Bethpage U.S. Open, they begged him to get up in front of the kids and play something, so he whispered to the band what he wanted. Pretty soon, they were wheeling into Knockin' on Heaven's Door. Oops. 2:15 a.m. Time for mullet-wearing legends to find a pillow, and still no recipe has made its way down Daly's famous gullet. Alcohol everywhere, and Daly has not had a sip. "When was your last drink?" I ask, just before he piles in the car as the designated driver. "August of last year, 2000, he says. "I had 3 beers that night at Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. I was having dinner with Shanai. I'm not saying I'm never having another drink. I might, you never know. But it's not something I want in my life. It's just all these people had all these expectations for me. But deep down, I just didn't think they had the answers. I mean, I went to AA meetings. They helped me, the 12 steps, with other stuff. The cigarettes, the pills, the gambling, the food. And, you know, alcohol too, I guess. I mean, I still talk to my mentor all the time. Finally, it just hit me. This is my life. Fuck the money. I was miserable. I couldn't live with the world's expectations anymore. I'm just a guy who's trying to get his life back together. I'm not going to worry about what people think about me." "And the millions you kicked away?" "Fuck the money," he says. "I couldn't have spent all of it anyway." I look at him. "Okay," Daly says, "I could." 7 a.m. Monday. Daly shows up at Willowbend right on time. "My first job," he says, "is to find him a Diet Coke." John Daly is not an orange juice guy. He is not a coffee guy. He is not a breakfast guy. He is a Diet Coke guy. He will drink them all day and all night. When he is lying on his deathbed someday, his IV will drip Diet Coke. It's not unusual for him to have 20 in a day. "I just love the taste of them," he says. He's also got a Marlboro going. He's a 2-packs-a-day guy, except when he's a 3-packs-a-day guy. John Daly is one of the great consumers in American history. "Somebody tried to get me to quit smoking," he says, shrugging. "They gotta be fucking kidding." "But aren't you afraid of lung cancer?" Daly nearly does a spit take. "Do you know how much stuff I could worry about? Hell, alcohol kills your liver. We're all dying every day. I know I'm gonna be in a box someday, 6 feet under." 8:36 a.m. Waiting for him on the range, there's time to rifle through his bag, as all good caddies must do. There's 2 dozen Titleist Pro 6 balls, 5 Zippo lighters, a large can of Zippo lighter fluid, a bottle of Bayer, a bottle of Allegra, a bottle of sunblock, a box of Band-Aids, 15 frickin' gloves, and 5 cigars packaged with lighters. Apparently, if we are all somehow trapped overnight on the 11th hole, Daly wants everybody to be able to smoke. As for clubs, everything is Titleist, including 3 Vokey wedges, 60, 52, and 48 degrees, forged Titleist 981 irons 2 through 9, a 12.5-degree Titleist 975J3 wood, and a Scotty Cameron putter. He's got no 5-wood. The big boy everybody wants to see him hit, the Johnny Wad Holmes of drivers, is a Titleist 975J7.5-degree that he's bent down to 6.5. 6.5 is damn near the loft of most putters. It's got a very stiff pinley shaft with gobs of lead tape on the bottom. It's covered by a big lion head cover, which is Daly's idea. He says the lion rules the jungle, and I want to control my jungle. What's mind-blowing is that Daly is playing Titleists for free. Nada. Scratch. Can you imagine that? The longest hitter on tour, 8 yards longer than Tiger in 2002... getting nothing to play his brand of clubs? It'd be like Miles Davis playing on a street corner, his horn case open for change. He used to have one of the richest club deals on tour, with Callaway. Daly just kept screwing up time after time, and each time the late owner Eli Callaway stuck with him. Eli agreed to pay off all of Daly's gambling debts, rumored to be $9 million, and let him continue with his deal, which still had $3 million left, on one condition. He stopped gambling, stopped drinking, and attend regular AA meetings. That was in the summer of 1999. Every week was another rumor. Daly was seen